everyone. This is March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening today to my interview with Islander Karen Cushman, recorded in the studio of Voice of Vashon. Karen, thank you for coming by.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And so I am super excited. I have wanted to have this interview with Karen for, oh my gosh, I think it's been months we've been talking about this. And I've had your books, because you have multiple books, and I've had three or four of them for a few months now. So this interview, folks, we are going to be covering a whole bunch of different concepts. This is going to have something for the writer out there, the reader out there, the teacher out there, the librarian out there. It's going to be a great interview.
I hope so.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is ask you to sort of give a quick little introduction of yourself, just to let the listeners sort of have a sense of context, sort of who you are,
okay.
Blah, blah, blah.
Okay. We've now been living on Vashon for 14 years. Before that, we were in the Bay Area for many years. I came late to writing. I started when I was almost 50. Before that, I taught for 11 years in a museum studies program at John F. Kennedy University in the Bay Area. Before that, I raised my daughter. And before that, I worked for the telephone company where we were not encouraged to tell stories, which was hard for me because I had always been a storyteller. I started writing when I was 5 or 6 years old. Still have a lot of those pieces, songs, stories, jump rope rhymes. And when I was a little older, I wrote a play about Santa Claus going down the wrong chimney on Christmas Eve and winding up in a Jewish home. It's called Jingle Bagels.
Oh, my God. How old were you?
Oh, 11, maybe, something like that.
Brilliant.
Yes. At 12, I wrote an epic poem cycle based on the life of Elvis. I never thought about being a writer. I didn't know anybody who was a writer. I didn't know any adults who wrote at all. I thought that I would be a school teacher or a librarian or, on my more optimistic days, Elvis's wife. I wrote because it felt good, that was something that I was allowed to do. I could let out feelings. I could mourn. I could be angry. I could ventilate. I could do all of these things that I wasn't supposed to do in my real life. So I wrote all during elementary school and high school. But after college, I didn't write anymore. I think it was intimidating that I was competing with all of these fabulous people who were writing. And I used to say, I used to write really well for a teenager, and now I write really well for a teenager, but I'm in my 20s, or I'm in my 30s or 40s.
Yeah.
I had lots of ideas, and I would tell my husband, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story. And then I would tell him, and that would be the end. Nothing else would happen. In maybe 1998, we were on vacation, and I woke up with an idea in my head. And I said to him, listen to this, I have a great idea for a story. And he said, you've been saying that for 25 years now, and I've never seen a word written on paper. This time, I refuse to listen.
Oh, good for him.
But I'll read it if you'll write it down. He's a psychologist, in case people couldn't tell from that, little
tidbit. I was like, yes. Okay.
Yes, indeed. So he handed me a notebook and a pen, and he closed the door of the little cabin we were staying at, and I wrote down what turned out to be a 7-page outline of Catherine Called Bertie, which was my first book.
Right, right, right.
And once I had something on paper, I felt more committed to it. I wanted to see what happened to this girl, how she handled this world she was living in, how it all turned out. So for the next 3 or 4 years, I worked on it. So that was how my first book came upon me.
That is such a brilliant story. And I didn't know that yet. Actually, I didn't even really know. That's awesome. That's like, that's just inspirational, I think, for every person out there who feels like, oh, well, you know, that musician got started when he was 19 and that actress got started when she was 21, and I'm 39, so I obviously missed the boat. Why would I even try?
Every time I speak, a couple of women, always women, come up to me and say, I am so inspired. Thank you for saying that, because I'm about to turn 50, or I just turned 50 and I haven't written anything and I really want to write. And I say, maybe you were too young. Maybe you were too busy. Maybe you had 6 kids and a part-time job and a husband, you know. But when the time is right, if you want to do it, you will do it. Something will happen.
Yeah.
But they're just so happy to hear that you don't have to start publishing in your 20s.
Right, yeah. Right. Or you don't have to have been constantly writing secretly,
that's right,
quietly,
that's right,
for 30 years.
That's right.
Becoming a great writer. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so you literally took a break from writing for all
that
time.
I did. I took a short break of what, almost 40-some years.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
And it worked out for me.
Well, there you go. So prose, poetry, and purpose, all about inspiring people.
There you go.
One reader, one listener at a time. Uh-huh. I hope there's some inspiration out there on the airwaves and on the internet waves. If you're listening on the radio and you come in partway or have to leave partway through, you can always go to voiceofashon.org and then check under the shows tab for prose, poetry, and purpose. You can listen to this show and every other show I've done. They're all archived right there, easy to find. So that's always something I like to remind people about. Okie doke. So today, these are my notes from when we were hanging out this morning. And you write for an age group that's currently called middle grade.
Right.
And it used to be called young adult. And there's been a shift. And I would love it if you could sort of explain that just real briefly so people understand that category.
I think there was always something called middle grade. I don't know. Sometimes they called it chapter books, different things. But what goes into each category has shifted. When I started out with Catherine Colberti and The Midwife's Apprentice, and even The Ballad of Lucy Whipple, my third book, they were considered young adult.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't change. I still write the same way. I still have a main character who's about 13, because someplace in my heart, that's how old I am. But the readership has changed, apparently, because what is considered young adult is much heavier, more serious, has more to do with romance, dystopia, death, terminal illnesses.
Oh, right, like All the Fault in Our Stars.
All of those, that's right. All of those.
Right.
They are much heavier, and so they're came this category called middle grade, which is like 6th grade to 9th grade with a year or so on either end. Our story, middle grade stories, can be as meaningful, but I think are not as downbeat.
Mm-hmm.
They don't end unhappily, or, you know, even happily, but somebody dies.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't usually happen. The characters, I was going to say, are a little more innocent, and that might not be the case. But they are not involved in sexual situations, in a life, usually serious life and death situations, that they're a little lighter for these little younger people.
It does seem like young adult is brilliantly attractive to the adult community as well.
That's right.
Whereas I would say, the middle grade, because right now I think technically young adult, they really want your character to, your protagonist to basically be about 16. 17's okay, 15's okay, but really they're aiming at 16. And middle grade, like you said, is more like the 12-year-olds and the 13-year-olds.
Right.
I mean, Anne Frank, how old was she when she wrote her diaries?
I think she was like 13.
Right.
She wasn't real old.
And you mentioned
14.
A couple of other great, that one author who you said was brilliant.
Oh, Laurie Hulse Anderson.
Say that name again.
Laurie Hulse Anderson.
Okay, got it. And she wrote
She's written a number of books, but my favorites are two of a trilogy. I keep hoping for the third called,
It's okay, two of a trilogy.
Two of a trilogy about African-American kids in the Revolutionary War, which was a fascinating take on history, a subject we think we know so well.
Right.
Yeah.
And so she's coming out from an angle that's been less illuminated.
That's right. Yeah, all of her books, I think, are that way.
Okay, so
now there's a new category that they're just coming up with, because apparently middle grade and young adult and adult aren't enough. Now it's called new adult, which for people who think they're a little old for young adult, why they don't think these kids can go and read adult, I don't know. So it's new adult. And that, again, is more sexual. and disturbing.
And often. I'm not sure it's going to stick. I was my novel, I was expecting would probably be new adult because I'm writing. Well, I want to specifically focus on the college age kids.
Yeah.
Of course, my novel has people of all sorts of ages and it's all over the planet. But the idea was that high schoolers, in a way, have a bit of a limit on the areas, the subject matter that they're interested in. I mean, you know, sex is usually a new and exciting territory for someone who's in high school, whereas once you're in college, oftentimes it's familiar territory. And so there were ways in which I feel that when I talk to high schoolers, they're starting to open the door on the adult world and they're blinking their eyes. When I talk to someone who's halfway through college, their feet are in the adult world. They're out there in the front yard and they're in it. And so I went to a writer's event last summer, I think, and I raised the question about that. And the people who were there, it was a bunch of agents and different people in the industry, and they said that new adults seem to be dying an early death. Because young adult, when you look at Hunger Games and other books like that, it's already trudging right into college age material and adult. And so new adult may end up not actually living. I don't know. It's like in flux right now.
I think it was a term and a category come up with probably by marketing departments who were afraid that older high school students and young college students wouldn't want to be seen shopping in a store with a young adult section.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. So they wanted to do these books that were, in a way, just a little further along than young adult, but not put them in the adult section where they would get lost with the millions and millions. But I think that was a marketing decision.
That would make sense.
Yes.
And so we'll see if it goes.
That's right. And marketing drives the bus often because your book can be the best book in the world. And if it's not marketed to the right people, if the right people don't find it, then it's not going to go anywhere.
I had a really great interview with Garth Stein.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. And he wrote about Enzo, the dog, right?
Yes,
the Art of Racing in the Rain and a couple of other books before that. And he has another one that just came out. And one of the points he made about Enzo and the Art of Racing in the Rain was that he calls up his agent after having given him this manuscript. And the agent basically said, you know, it's narrated by a dog. No one's going to publish a book that's narrated by a dog. I can't sell a book that's narrated by a dog. Go throw this book in the trash. Do me a favor.
Really?
And write me something I can sell. And Garth's response, he says to me, well, two words popped into my head. And he's like, they're not the words that I can't say on the radio. He said, you're fired. And a number of months later, like 7 or 8 months later, he's at an event. He's been trying to find a new agent for this book, which was his third book. And everyone's like, I love it, blah, 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 blah. But I don't know how to sell it. It's narrated by a dog. And then he's at an event, one of the fundraisers for King County Library. And he's meeting with all these other authors at the pre-dinner. And they're going around a circle. And he says, you know, I'm really frustrated. I've got this book. I think it's a great book, but it's narrated by a dog and I can't get anyone to pick it up, you know? And this guy across the table lifts his head up and says, well, you should talk to my agent because my book is narrated by a crow. And he was able to sell it. So Garth sends this book to that agent. And like 48 hours later, the agent calls him up crying on the phone and says, my God, you have to give me this book.
Yeah.
And of course, it spent, what was it, like a couple of years on the New York Times bestseller list? I mean, it's this brilliant, brilliant story, which has touched so many millions of hearts.
He just needed an agent with a little imagination.
And that agent obviously needed to know how to intersect with the marketing department.
That's right.
You know, he had to come and say, not only is it great, but here's how you market it.
That's right.
Okay, so that's the business side. you have, to give people a sense, folks, there's a whole bunch of lovely books, and you can go to Karen's website if you want to get some more information about the ones that we're not going to have time to talk about today. Additionally, there's a Facebook page that has content added to it. Now, this young woman who runs it for you, is she part of the publishing company?
No, she's a person who does social media management, they call
it. Okay, brilliant.
And she's in Minnesota.
Nice.
Yes. So she finds content related to my books and researches it and puts it on the Facebook page, which is fantastic.
Right, like you were saying that, so this book, The Loud Silence of Francine Green, this one is talking roughly about what was happening in the 1950s and right. with sort of the blacklisting of people and all the fear-mongering in mm-hmm. America and the anti-Soviet and, you know, and all that. Okay, so you said she went out and she found authentic historical information
That's
sort of
right.
about what was going
right.
on and wrote an article about that.
Or she would publish a link to a film, a documentary film about
nice.
The era. And then the next week she would have interviews with people. And then the next week
right.
she'd have a bio of Joe McCarthy or something.
Right.
But all of these things that are related that are so helpful to teachers
yes.
who are using the book in the classroom.
And homeschooling parents.
And homeschooling parents, yes.
So yeah. that's what I was going to say, folks, is the Facebook page. What's is it just Karen Cushman?
It should just be Karen Cushman. It could be Karen Cushman author, but I think they tried to get rid of that.
Got it. Okay, folks, I know you're savvy enough to handle this. So go to Facebook and look up Karen with a K and Cushman with a C, C-U-S-H-M-A-N. And what's brilliant is that because all of these are historically based, they are sort of like little windows into these different times. And so, yeah, if you're homeschooling your kids, girls and boys alike, what's the one that my son read?
Will Sparrow's Road.
So some of the protagonists are boys and girls. It mixes up. Okay, so I wanted to make sure to mention that.
Okay.
On Facebook, you can
right.
explore
and
so much.
And my website is KarenCushman.com,
right.
obviously.
Exactly. Okay, doke. So you write in middle grade, and you have three books that are based in the medieval world, three books that are based in California during slightly different, over about a 100-year
yes.
window,
mm-hmm.
right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Two books written in the Elizabethan era.
Right.
And you have one book. The first one was a Newbery Honor.
A Newbery Honor. Catherine Colberti was given a Newbery Honor.
Right. Yay.
Yes.
And then The Midwife's Apprentice was the
That's right.
Newbery
the
Medal book of that year.
1996.
Yes. All right. Well, why don't you briefly tease the writers on the island who want to continue to be published authors or become a published author. Give us a little bit of a teaser about how glorious it is to
it is glorious.
Go through the Newbery honor and medalist experience.
I usually equate winning the Newbery Medal with the Vatican choosing a new pope, because it's not like there are nominees or people on a short list or a long list.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing said. It's completely secret. And in Rome, when there's a new pope, white smoke goes up in the chimney. If there's not a new pope elected, then a black smoke goes up in the chimney. And so you just have to wait around for white smoke
so
to appear.
So each day, smoke at the end of the day.
That's right.
Will
they take ballots and they burn them. So after I wrote Catherine Colberti, my husband kept saying, oh, you're going to win, you're going to win, because he's an optimist and because he's incredibly supportive of me. And I kept saying, no, it's my first book. They'll never do anything. So we went to bed the
wait,
night.
Wait. Okay.
Yes.
It's your first book. How is it that you're even thinking about the Newbery at this point?
Because, I knew that there was such a thing, and he knew there was such a thing, and he had just decided that I was going to win it.
So everyone who writes in the middle grade,
no,
any book,
uh-huh.
adult as well.
They're not usually adult books.
Okay.
They're books for children, often a young adult, though there is now a special category for young adult.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that they can't also win the Newbery. And as I said, this year, Last Stop on Market Street, which is a picture book,
mm-hmm.
won the Newbery Medal. And that doesn't happen very often.
Okay, so he's just basically saying randomly, you published
right.
a book this
that's
year,
right.
you're an awesome woman, I love what you do, and you're going to be Newbery.
That's right.
You're like, honey.
So we went to bed not knowing that the Newbery was going to be announced the next morning. And it's announced at 8 o'clock in the morning, usually on the East Coast, which is
New
where
York.
It can be anywhere in there. It's at the midsummer meeting of the American Library Association.
Oh.
It's usually on the East Coast because that's closer to where all the publishers are.
Right, exactly.
And it's announced to the press at 8 in the morning, and they like to talk to the authors first and tell them. Which means we lived in California, and
uh-huh.
it means it was 5 o'clock in the morning when the telephone rang.
Uh-huh.
And Philip picked it up, and I heard some voice go, wah, 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 and he said, do you know what time it is? And the person said, wah, 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 wah. And I said, well, who is it? What is it? Is there a problem? And he said, it's some librarian. And I said, give it here. So he gave it to me.
As he's grousing about the time of day.
That's right. He gave it to me. And the person announced that it was indeed the American Library Association, and Catherine Colberti had been named a Newbery Honor Book. Aww. Well, we were very excited, but he was humiliated that he didn't handle that any better.
Oh, we'll have to
put... Wow. So he said next year, because I had already written the Midwife's Apprentice, he said next year it's going to win the Newbery Honor. I mean, the medal.
The medal.
And I'm going to answer the phone, and I'm going to do a really smooth job. So the next year we knew when the Newbery was going to be announced.
Right.
And he was sure I was going to win the medal. And I said, they're not going to give me anything. You can tell who's the pessimist in the family. Right. I already won the honor last year. They're not going to do two in a row, blah, blah, blah. So we went to bed, and he put the cordless phone next to his side of the bed. Aww. And he practiced sitting up and answering in one smooth motion. Hello. Hello. So that he would do
it. He has a great sense of humor, too, apparently.
He does. Yes, he does.
Oh, my goodness.
So the next morning, the phone rang at 5:05 or something. He reached out and got it, and he knocked it off the bedside table, and it went under the bed. So he's under the bed trying to get the phone. I'm screaming, get the phone, get the phone, as if I don't answer, they'll say, well, hell with her. We'll give it to somebody else. So finally he came out.
Black smoke.
Finally he came out with the phone in his hand, and the Midwife's Apprentice had won the Newbery Medal. So we jumped around and cried for a while, and then he went and got a bottle of champagne that he had hidden in the refrigerator. He was that certain the book was going to win. Of course, he's been certain every year since.
Right, it hasn't
happened. But he was right those two times.
Wow.
And winning the Newbery Medal does change your life. First of all, I got flowers from probably 25 people across the country, which was wonderful. Bookstores, especially children's bookstores, but most big bookstores have a section of Newbery winners, and they stay in print forever, and the bookstores keep them on the shelves.
Right.
I spoke on television and on the radio and did some filmed interviews, and I haven't had any trouble selling my books ever since. So it does make a big difference. But the most important thing was that I thought of myself finally as an author. Mm-hmm. I wasn't just somebody who had written these two books. Mm-hmm. You know, that I thought of myself as an author. This is what I do.
Right.
And it took me a couple more before I quit my day job, which was teaching at this museum studies program. But finally, I was able to do that. And that meant after a couple of years, we could move away from the Bay Area, which we did, and came here. Yes. So that's when you win the Newbery, those of you who are listening, take a lesson from Phil. You know, if your phone rings at 5 in the morning, it could be good news.
And maybe duct tape it to the wall so you're not going to sit up and knock it under the bed. So your wife's screaming in the background while you're trying to get it.
There you go.
That's hilarious. I love it. Better. That's much better than if he had succeeded at his.
Oh, yes. Hello. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. Much better.
This was the best way to do it.
Yay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I imagine there's a bunch of people right now who have just pulled over in their cars and then whipped out their little notebook, and they're scribbling down the thought they have about this book that's been percolating in their head. And they are like, I'm going to do it. So you go, people. You go do it. And you know what? Most of you who want to write a book, or already working on a book, you've got a message that you want to get out there. You have something to say, because if you didn't, you wouldn't be writing anything down on paper. And so one of the cool things about what you've done, Karen, is you have managed to succeed at this thing that's really sort of hard. Everyone out there has probably read the book where you get into the second or third chapter and you put the book away because you just read a 3-page rant or lecture from the author via the voice of his character. And you just realized that this author is basically going to be up on a soapbox through the entire book. And that breaks the What's that thing they say when you're watching a movie?
Third wall.
Well, there's a third wall, mm-hmm. yeah, but there's also the suspension of disbelief.
Yes, right.
You know, like, la, la, I'm in a spaceship and I'm out there and suddenly I'm being lectured at about something that sounds like coming from a talk show host, you know, or something like that. So your stories, especially in the middle grade, were so important because as a society, we really want to offer insightful stories to youth at that age that can help to guide them, you know, forward in a way that's more enlightened and more ethical, more self-aware. I mean, we're really loving our children at that age and trying to help them. And all of your stories have a real message and a goal sort of that you had for the readers, but you don't do that horrible lectury thing.
Mm-mm.
And I'm so grateful. Could you maybe go through and say, you know, this one, I was curious about exploring this issue, and this one I wanted to help people think of that issue. And
okay.
Pick like three or four of your favorite to highlight. And let's make sure The Loud Silence of Francine Green is the last one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah?
All right.
Okay.
First, I'm going to do my little Lego talk.
Ooh,
because
yes.
That's how all this comes together. I'm always asked by young people and very often by adults, where do you get your ideas?
Right.
You know,
right,
how does a story come to you? And I was trying to think of a way to explain this to a group of fifth graders. And
that would be 10-year-olds, folks.
Okay. And I thought about an example of little pieces coming and putting them together. So because that's how ideas come, a character over here or a time period or values or that I want to talk about or a problem, something, all of those things come and they are coming together before they're a fully formed idea. So I tried to think of an example of that in the physical world and I thought, Lincoln Logs. Well, these kids had no idea what I was talking about.
I loved them.
Tinker Toys.
They didn't have a clue.
Not a clue. So brilliant. Legos. Then they got it.
Everyone gets Legos.
A Lego is just a colored block. If you have one Lego, you have a red colored block, and that's all. But if you put a yellow Lego and a blue and more reds and wheels and do all of these things and put them together, you can make a car or a house or an entire village of buildings with Legos. And that's the way I think ideas come. Alchemy and Maggie Swan, which is one of the Elizabethan books, the whole idea started because I was reading something about alchemy, which is the transformation of base metals to gold, which was supposedly one step on the way to finding the secret to eternal life. So I thought, what if there was this man who was an alchemist and he had a daughter? Because I had to have a young person character.
Mm-hmm.
So what would she think all about this? And she gets really she's sent to live with him. She gets really involved. Why was she so involved with alchemy? Well, alchemy is about transformation. Maybe she wanted to be transformed in some way. So I thought, well, what? Does she want curly hair or, you know, mm-hmm. better clothes? I thought, what if she had some kind of serious physical problem? And she thought if her father found the secret to transformation of material things, he could transform her and mm-hmm. cure her. Then I thought, well, in the Middle Ages, if she, what she has is bilateral hip dysplasia, which means that she walks with this funny lumbering walk and needs mm-hmm. a cane. And I thought if she was in the Middle Ages, they thought that most illnesses and especially deformities, so-called deformities, were punishments from God for evil or meaning that you were in league with the devil. And I didn't want that to come up. So I had to find a time period mm-hmm. where her problem couldn't be cured mm-hmm. because they didn't know how to do that yet, but where it wasn't considered by everybody to be a sign that she was evil and was being punished by God.
Mm-hmm.
So then the alchemy, her hip dysplasia, and the time period, and I picked London because there's so much information about Elizabethan London, those mm-hmm. things all came together there. And I wanted to talk about a girl who was not perfect, the way we all are not perfect. So that was another one that came in. She had been raised by a grandparent and was sent to live with a father she had never met. So she was angry and unhappy and not very likable at first. So that all of that mm-hmm. went in. And still, she was able to change and to grow. So all of those things were like Legos where they came together to mm-hmm. make this story.
Right.
And I think that's the way the stories come together. The Midwife's Apprentice I had no idea what it was going to be about.
And that one is that's the medieval.
That's a medieval one. Right. It was. Oh, that's the one that won the Newbery Medal.
Right.
And when I started, I had just the title. I had it written on a piece of paper in a drawer for, I'd say, a year, because I didn't know what the story was about. But I liked what it said about learning, which is apprentice, and midwife was birth. So those were two Legos that came in there. And I didn't know anything else. And then I had the image of this homeless child sleeping on a dung heap, because as the those of us on Vashon know, we rural types, those city types, often don't know it. As the material rots and turns into compost, it gives off heat.
Oh, yeah.
And it's soft. So there she was burrowed in the dung heap. So it gave me a place to start. There was this child who had nothing. She was called Brat by the populace. She was homeless. She had no name. She was hungry. She longed for a place in the world. And even starting from zero there, as all of these pieces came together, she was able to grow into a person with a name, a full belly, and a place in the world.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how things come together. It's not, I'm going to write a book about, I can say that now, because all 8 or 9 of my last books weren't like that. But Catherine Colberti came to me all of a piece, almost in a dream. So I have to stop saying that that's not the way it works.
Sometimes
it worked that way. With all the other times, it's just these different Legos coming together and building a construction. And then as I write, I change out the Legos. No, this one doesn't work. This one, let's have this instead. Right. So that's the way they work.
So let's see, the California Trio, I thought it'd be really cool if you could actually talk a little bit about the Orphan Train.
Then
we'll jump into Francine.
Okay. From, I think it's 1850 to 1920, there were these projects called orphan trains where homeless or orphaned children were taken from the slums of big cities, first to the south and then out west, looking for new homes for them. Sometimes it turned out the children were not homeless or orphaned, but social worker decided they'd be better off with another family.
Right.
Families were often split up. People found out much later that they were Jewish or they were Irish, but those orphans weren't taken as readily, so that they were sold as Swedish or whatever was more adoptable. So I wanted to write about the orphan trains. I saw the picture of a train on the cover of a nonfiction book in a bookstore, and there was this enormous locomotive and this line of tiny children with little cardboard suitcases, and their faces looked so brave and so frightened and so hopeful all at the same time that I knew that there would be a story there. So I went in search of Rodzina. I'm not sure how to spell the name. And she's a writer on the orphan train, and she's unwilling to go, but she's unwilling to be taken. However, she's unwilling to just stay on the train forever, and what she figures out and how she finds a home is the story. My father's family is Polish, and as I was growing up, I always thought my great-grandmother's name, first name, was Rodzina Chedwinski, because my grandma would take us to the Polish cemetery, and she would sit and cry by this tombstone that said Rodzina Chedwinski, and I thought that was my great-grandmother's grave. But it turns out that Rodzina is the Polish word for family. So that this grave site was the burial plot of the Chedwinski family. But instead of changing her name, I left it, because I thought in a book that's all about the search for family, that it was a good name for her. Even though probably no children were named Rodzina, just like we don't name children family. I thought that it was a really good name and that it really told you what the story was about. And I put that story in the beginning of the book.
Oh, so there's the personal story there.
Yeah, so the people who read it know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you think about Ellis Island, I mean, there were so many people who, you know, I speak English and you come in from some other country, and they would just hear the person pronounce it and they would rewrite it.
That's right.
So I could actually see that as being a name. Why
That's
not?
Right.
Because
That's right.
there could be a translation confusion.
That's right.
Next thing you know, you've got this funky
said,
name.
Yeah, yeah, I'm part of the Chedwinski family, and they would, you know, and they'd write it down in Polish. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, the Orphan Train, like, I've never even heard of that. I'm really glad you wrote about it. I had no clue that even happened.
You can go online and look up the Orphan Train. There's an Orphan Train Writers Association where a lot of survivors of the Orphan Train and their families come together, because the last train ran in 1920, mm-hmm. so that we're about to lose
right.
the last writers, and their stories are so important.
Right.
A number of places throughout the country, mostly from Chicago West, like Nebraska and not the Dakota, so it must be Minnesota and some other places. It's part of the school curriculum. Because mm-hmm. they were stops for the Orphan Train. So they had people actually in their community who were Orphan Train riders or descendants of. So they've made these curriculum units the Orphan Train.
Yeah. It's really interesting, actually, middle school history, because they always have the local piece about the state that you live in.
Right.
So, like, I spent, 1 year of middle school was in California. So during that year, I was picking up on the California history and the natives and the, the missionaries and the disease and all that, right? But the previous year, I'd been living in Reno, Nevada. And when you live in Nevada, you learn all about the Donner Party.
Right.
And if I had been in California, I never would have learned anything about the Donner Party. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, you could probably make an entire study of, the unique aspects of each state that
That's
is
right.
taught to the children that live in that state.
That's right. It's part of our culture,
I know,
and we are products of our culture, and we also develop our culture.
Right.
It's a two-way street, so that...
What we remember helps to create what
that's
we believe.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'm going to remind everyone really quickly that you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, the show where authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. My name is Marge Twisdale. I'm speaking today with Karen Cushman, and she has been an Islander for about 14 years, has a number of books. We are having a great time today. If you want to catch what you missed, you can go to voiceofvashon.org and catch the beginning of the show there. And if you want to catch up on some of these books, Karen is lucky enough, Karen Cushman, Karen with a K, Cushman with a C. She has a lovely woman who manages her Facebook page for her. And because all of these books, which are written for middle grade genre, they all have a historical component, either medieval or California history or Elizabethan era. Because of that, she goes in and she pulls real, concrete, interesting pieces of history that have to do with the storyline. And so if you're a homeschooler or a teacher or just a parent of a young kid or someone who loves history, you can go there and get all these amazing sort of additional side perspectives and stuff. She fleshes out the story,
yes,
basically.
Yes, that's what she does.
Oh,
context.
Okay.
She puts in the context.
Oh, my husband always is saying, it's about the context. I'm like, yes.
Mine too.
Your husband. We should get them together sometime. Okay, so we are at, we're doing really great on this interview. We're going to have plenty of time to talk about Francine Green and also Grayling's song.
Great.
So let's see here. The Loud Silence of Francine Green. Why don't you give a quick little intro to the story?
All right. Here's the first Lego. I had a friend whose father was a screenwriter in Hollywood and was blacklisted. And they went and for a year, they left. And for a year, they lived in motels in the desert before they went to New York, where he wrote under a different name. And I thought that would be fascinating for kids who had no idea about the blacklist or about the House Un-American Activities or the Senate Un-American Activities Committees, all of that. So that was really the first Lego. And because I knew the girl, I thought, well, it's one thing for the father to go through this and even his wife, but what about for the children? What was it like for the children to have to do this? So I came up with the idea for Francine Green, who had a friend named Sophie, whose father was a screenwriter. And Sophie was outgoing. Sophie was a troublemaker, always stood up for what she thought was right and pushed for it. And Sophie was always in trouble at school. And Francine was quiet and introverted and for strange reasons became friends with Sophie. And through her friendship, Francine learned not to be Sophie, not to be like that, but to believe that there were some things that were so important, you had to stand up for them, even if you got into trouble.
Right. One of the reasons I was really attracted to the loud silence of Francine Greene is because I think, you know, historically, in a largely patriarchal planet, women are oftentimes endangered. They speak up, so voices are often just pushed out because you're female.
That's right.
And then if you're a child,
that's right.
You're oftentimes literally a second-class citizen. I mean, there are obviously countries where parents can murder their children and get away with it. No one even complains about it. You know, family honor is more important than the life of the child. So we have all these pieces going into this, feeding into this.
That's
and then you're bringing to light the fact that we have in our history, I always look at history as like a playbook. Mm-hmm. If you think about football, they have a playbook and they'll open it up and they'll say, okay, so we've studied the history of all these football games and we know that in this type of a situation, there's this percentage of a chance that they're going to choose to do that. And literally the science of trying to predict the next play in football is massive, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I always look at history in general as the playbook of life. You know, that if people are making billions of dollars on football by paying attention to history and using that to predict the future, why are we not looking at history and trying to do
absolutely
the same thing?
History is losing a lot of its importance and its place. I talk to kids all the time who say, I don't like history. I don't pay any attention.
Mm-hmm.
But Francine's story, as relevant as it is to her time, a time when people were frightened. China had developed an atom bomb.
Mm-hmm.
It was believed that the communists wanted to take over the world, and they were in China and in Russia, and mm-hmm. some said in Hollywood. So everybody was fearful. The thing to do when you're fearful at that time, given their context,
mm-hmm.
was to shut up, to conform, to be quiet, to back off and let the bullies take over.
Right.
And the bullies in Congress developed these tools, these committees, a book called Red Channels, in which everybody who was suspected of being a communist or having communist leanings
mm-hmm.
or joined a group that they thought was too left wing
right.
were listed. And executives at movie studios and at radio programs, all of these people
right.
knuckled under to the bullies, and these people lost their jobs.
Right.
That was there's a movie called Trumbo. Out
I just looked it up
right
yes.
now. That
that
real is really
yes.
interesting about that period, and I thought that this would be a good period in which to have Francine knuckle under herself
yeah.
to the bullies at her school, her parents who wanted her to be quiet and conform,
mm-hmm.
and so that she was getting it from all sides. And it was very courageous of her, though mm-hmm. she didn't think of herself as a brave person, to finally say, there's something I have to stand up for. And that's
right.
when Sophie gets in trouble. And Francine has to make some sort of a statement about how unfair she thought that was.
Well, and it's interesting that when all of that was happening in America in the 50s, that's a decade to a decade and a half after we watched the same behavior in the European
that's
continent.
Right.
And we watched, I mean, you know, the stories of, you mm-hmm. know, the lone Jewish man who would show up in a small town and say, I have seen what they're doing. You mm-hmm. need to flee. You need to leave.
Right.
And everyone in town would say, no, our German neighbors couldn't
that's
do
right.
that to
that's
us.
Right.
We'll just sit here, you know. And I mean, we saw the negative impact of powerlessness through fear and mm-hmm. letting bullies take over.
Mm-hmm.
And then 10 years later, it's happening in this country during the 50s. And now I know so many people who will jokingly, but they
mm-hmm.
mean it,
mm-hmm.
say, well, I'm not so sure I can go research that topic because then probably the NSA is going to realize that I was
somebody's
looking
watching
at
atom
bombs
right.
or this or that.
That's
and I
right.
don't want to get put on a list. So we're like using all the verbiage that says we recognize
mm-hmm.
there are people in the government who will spy on our own people, who will track our actions and what we do, and that our access to information can be mm-hmm. used as a weapon against us to put us on a list, just people
yeah.
who then are at risk.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is the book that children right now,
yeah.
if they can read this, It's brilliant.
In the early 40s, there was a category called premature anti-fascists, which means they were people who were against Germany and Hitler before everybody was. And they were suspected of having communist leanings because they were premature anti-fascists. So their book, their playbook was this Red Channels thing.
Oh.
Then after that, it was Hoover's FBI files
right,
that
right.
were finding out he had these incredible files on mm-hmm. all sorts of people, from movie stars to Martin Luther King and mm-hmm. to ordinary people.
Yeah.
That was their playbook.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was not used for positive effect
no.
to the country, and it was misused
right.
because
that's right.
one of the things I often tell my children or in conversation, I'll say, you know, the thing we have to understand about humans on planet Earth is that whenever a place of power develops, you know, there is a position of power, there will be a few truly good moral people who have the ability to not cave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there will be a few strong, good people mm-hmm. who will consider going to that place and maybe doing good.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be a flock
right.
of bad people, to use a simple mm-hmm. term, who are drawn to that because power will allow them to get what they want. And so every time a position of power comes up, we must be on the alert for the wrong people who are going to want that.
That's right. And to see what messages they are giving us about
yeah.
strangers and immigrants. That was the same thing in Nazi Germany, about somebody who knows what to do, who has the truth, who has the one way to do something
right.
or fix something. All of these clues
yep.
should come to us
yep.
when we're looking around.
And what's happening right now in
That's
2016.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, in 2015.
We just saw The Big Short.
I want everyone on the island to go see
Absolutely.
This movie.
About how the banks and eventually the government colluded
yep.
about this subprime mortgage failure and the recession it led to. And the only people who lost money were the government. No. The bankers? No.
No.
The big banking institutions? No.
No.
There were those little families in Las Vegas that were struggling to pay for their house and mm-hmm. owed more than they could sell it for.
Right.
So I think it's really something to see. We left.
It's like a giant vacuum cleaner was just spread all over the country, and basically all of the wealth of the middle class and the edges of wealth that the lower classes were starting to have
mm-hmm.
some sense of security about,
yeah.
you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's really an instructive movie to and very entertaining.
Well, and I'm so impressed with the actors that are in the movie, the people who produced the movie, because what's really brilliant, if people, there's a myth out there of, well, they didn't know.
Right. That's right.
And
these people knew.
They knew exactly what was going on. They were not confused, and they said, nah.
They dismissed
nah.
it. Yeah.
Either they dismissed it, or they literally were like, well, you know, we like it the way it is. This is good for us. So
we will profit by it.
Yeah.
Right, right.
So then these people said, well, we're going to prove that we were right. Mm-hmm. And that was when they did that thing technically called, or casually called, betting against the American
mm-hmm.
economy.
Right.
By doing
Short
that,
sales.
They were able
mm-hmm.
to prove when they won,
mm-hmm.
they were able to prove that they had actually really been there predicting it and trying to fix it early
on. But only two of them at the end, I forget how many there were, maybe 10, let's say
right.
10 involved.
Right.
Only two of them expressed any sort of moral hesitancy
right.
about doing this because they got very rich
yep.
off of what they did. The others just were happy with having made this money and making fools of the banks.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. Anyways, okay, so yes, The Big Short
right.
is a brilliant movie to see. Trumbo is the one that's about Hollywood screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, who, what's that big giant movie that he actually wrote?
He wrote Roman Holiday.
No, there was another one, though. The big
the
one,
Ben-Hur,
no.
No, no, no.
Was it just Roman Holiday?
He wrote a number of movies. He wrote something called The Brave One, which I've never seen. And he wrote Roman Holiday after he was blacklisted, though, and he had to use somebody else's name. So somebody
right.
else got the Oscar credit for Roman Holiday until
right.
like 20 years later when, you know, it was a well-known secret that he had written that as well as a couple of other movies.
Right, right, right.
So it was
right,
much
right.
later that it came out. Once we started to fear, immigrants instead of communists. I don't know. We always have to have somebody to be afraid of, I suppose.
Right. Okay, so it says here it was Kirk Douglas, producer and star.
Oh, Spartacus.
Yes.
Producer and star
of the Oscar-winning 1960 epic Spartacus, who's acknowledged to have finally broken the blacklist when he insisted that Trumbo's name appear on the opening credits as the sole writer of the film. So what had been happening is he had been forced to write under a pseudonym for many years. And so all these people didn't realize that these great movies that they all love so much were being written by this person.
And he wasn't the only person to do that.
A lot of them did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm super excited. So that's Trumbo. Mm-hmm. And I think that's already on like my Netflix list or something like that of movie to get. Okay. So we are just about done. And you have a new book that is coming out in a new genre Grayling's Song.
That's right. And it's a fantasy. It's sort of a gentle fantasy. You might call it medieval with magic.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the points I wanted to make, I had been reading a lot of fantasies because maybe I should do something different. They're all historical novels about young girls who conquer the odds.
Or boys.
One about a boy. That's right. So I was reading a lot of fantasy and they depended on magic.
Right.
And I wanted to write a book that's about magic, but the thing is that magic doesn't work. It doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't fix the situation. That it turns out that Maggie uses her wits and her common sense and these companions that she picks up along the way to solve the problem. And I wanted young people to know there isn't magic. Don't depend on magic. You're not going to wake up different tomorrow or things aren't going to be different.
Magical thinking, in other words, can really slow us down.
That's right. No magical thinking. That you use the gifts that you have, you know, your talents or your intuition or your intelligence or, as I said about Maggie, her common sense. And you don't have to be perfect or courageous. You don't have to be, we were talking earlier about the main character from The Hunger Games, who is, of course, the strongest, prettiest, smartest, toughest person, and that's how she happens to win the Hunger Games. You don't have to be that. You can be an ordinary girl like Grayling, who is unsure of her abilities, whose mother calls her names sometimes because she's not tough enough, who doesn't know what she's doing and is sort of making it up as she goes along, but who has the ability to hear our mother's grimoire, which is a book that it can be a book of magic spells, but for a wise woman is a book of recipes and chants and things like that. She has the ability to hear it singing so that she's able to lead this group to find it and to solve the problem.
Right.
You have to be not Katniss Everdeen. You have to be who you are and be the best you that you can be with your faults and your limitations and all of your abilities and skills.
Right.
Yeah. So that's very much what it's about. It's sort of medieval in its texture. It's kind of in that kind of
time period.
And because I wanted some people to believe in magic and some people not, and for them to encounter people who wanted to use them for different kinds of purposes.
Right.
So, and because it's a place that I'm comfortable researching and writing about.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
So Grayling's Song.
That's right.
And it comes out on June 7th, 2016.
Yeah.
And wow, Karen, this has just been so much fun.
Good. I enjoyed it.
And that's our show, folks. My name is Marge Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview with Karen Cushman. Thank you for tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guest authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And honestly, Karen, I think you're just all over that.
Good.
For those of you who live on or visit Vashon Island, you can drop by the Vashon Bookshop and flip through a display copy of The Loud Silence of Francine Green. If people are wanting to take a look and flip through a few of these and maybe chat with their kids about, you know, how empowered you can be as a young person during the spring, summer, and fall when the farmer's market is running on Vashon Island, you can always drop by the local Vore Lit booth and browse through a whole bunch of books that are offered by local authors only. Okie doke. Okay.
Thank you, March.
Yes, thank you very much. And I will leave you all now with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices, the view, till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many. You are the few.